And now to President Biden's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson started courtesy meetings with senators this week ahead of her confirmation hearings that get underway in a little over 2 weeks. We're exploring women judges over the decades who have been in the running, shortlisted for nomination, but ultimately got passed over, and how their stories inform the present day. Do you think diversity should be considered when judges are appointed to the Supreme Court? It's 800-642-1234. Renee Kanaki Jefferson is a law professor at the University of Houston, co-authored the book Shortlisted, published in 2020. Renee, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Judge Jackson, first Black woman to be nominated to the High Court, which was made up entirely of white men for almost two centuries. What do you make of this moment?
Well, it's historic for many reasons. It's a long time coming. Women, Black women, have been on president's shortlists for over 40 years. And for the entire time, women were allowed to join the Supreme Court. That, of course, was in 1981, when Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice on the court. With this nomination, the Supreme Court takes another step forward in better reflecting the public that it serves, and that we will now see a Black woman on the High Court. But Judge Jackson brings far more diversity than simply her race and her gender. She also will be the only justice on the Supreme Court who has served as a federal public defender. And that's important because our public defenders are the lawyers who represent individuals faced with criminal charges who can't afford an attorney. And so she'll be bringing a very different perspective based on work that she did before she became a judge. And then I'll also just note, her nomination is quite extraordinary because she has such deep experience. She's been a judge for many years, and as I said, had a range of experiences as a lawyer prior to coming to the bench, not just being a public defender, but also serving on the U.S. Sentencing Commission and in other capacities. So it's an incredible moment. It's hopefully a moment to set aside partisanship and really celebrate in the life of this country.
It's interesting, your perspective, too, and what you bring to light. And it aligns what I think what the press has been talking about with this judge. But it was really interesting to me because you study how the media portray these nominees. And, you know, even going back to the 1950s with the California Appeals Court Judge Mildred Lilly in the shortlisted in the Nixon years. What is significant about the treatment of these potential nominees and how they get shown in the press?
Well, let's talk about Judge Lilly for just a second. So part of what inspired the what's now our book, Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court, was an article that we found. It was actually written in 1971. It was published in the New York Times, and it listed Richard Nixon's shortlist. He was the first president to allow his shortlist to go public, if you will. And on that list were two names that were women and four men. The two women were Sylvia Bacon, a judge in Washington, D.C., and Mildred Lilly, as you note, a judge from California. In addition to listing her extensive qualities that made her qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, the article noted that she maintained her bathing beauty figure even in her 50s and fortunately had no children. Needless to say, none of the men in that article had any reference to how they looked in their swim trunks. And of course, that reflected the really explicit overt sexism of that era where, you know, thinking back to the late 60s and early 70s, women were regularly still excluded from professional life and from the workplace. You would think now in 2022 that this kind of gendered coverage has changed. And I'm ever optimistic, but I will tell you that so far things are not looking like they will have improved very much for Judge Jackson. She is already getting scrutiny that we have not seen male nominees get for the court. I've studied this. I've looked at every article written by the New York Times and the Washington Post going back to the early 70s through the nominations of actually Judges Kagan and Sotomayor. And what that study showed is that women are more likely to be scrutinized for qualities that have nothing to do with being a Supreme Court justice, whether it's their appearance or their marital status. And the headline that I think is getting a lot of buzz right now is a, a recent reporter was focusing on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's LSAT score. That, of course, is the test you have to take to get into law school. It would sort of like be, you know, asking how's she performing on her Wordle puzzles? It's a really sort of silly inquiry. I guarantee you, if President Biden had selected a white man, no one would be asking his LSAT score. And so I think we're going to see coverage continue that has nothing to do with the nominee's qualifications to sit on the court.
Something that I hadn't thought about that you raise in your book is how the testimony that comes from the American Bar Association, and how one of your women in history who got an unqualified ranking from the American Bar Association, who was totally qualified, but how much does the ABA factor in here?
Well, the ABA used to have a pretty significant role in vetting nominees to the court. That started in the Eisenhower era. He was not a lawyer or a judge himself and reached out to the American Bar Association to assist in vetting judges. But there really was a change in the ABA's role after Reagan, in part because, as you note, in those years, so the judge in particular that the ABA ranked and qualified was Mildred Lilly, who we were just talking about, a judge from California. She was completely qualified to be on the Supreme Court. In fact, in a later interview, Nixon, of course, was the president who was considering her, and his White House counsel, John Dean, in a later interview said he looked at Lilly's resume next to that of Sandra Day O'Connor, and she was equally, if not more qualified than O'Connor to join the court. And so the American Bar Association at that time was really known for deliberately ranking women and minorities as unqualified or less qualified as a way to exclude them from ascending onto the court. Now, fast forward to today, I anticipate that the ABA will rank Judge Jackson well qualified. She'll get their highest qualification. The role of the American Bar Association now is no longer one to vet who comes off the shortlist, but instead to sort of provide advice once we know who the nominee is. So it's a different function. And also the American Bar Association has really evolved from being an organization that was prohibiting diversity to one that is really championing it now.
And notably too, the ABA gives remarks on the final day of her confirmation hearings.
Yes. And so again, because she has been repeatedly confirmed already by the Senate and gone through the ABA review process, I think we will have no surprises here. Uh-huh. And in fact, that's probably part of why President Biden has selected her. He had a long list of extraordinarily qualified Black women to put on the court. One thing that does set Judge Jackson apart is the fact that she has been confirmed repeatedly by the Senate, and in fact, by this very same Senate just last year when she was elevated to her seat on the DC Circuit Court of Appeals. She received bipartisan support, which is pretty extraordinary in this era of such partisanship. Yeah, so I anticipate, although she will probably go through quite grueling hearings and a lot of unpleasant scrutiny, that she will be confirmed.
University of Houston law professor Renee Konaki Jefferson is an expert on professional responsibility, legal ethics, studies the media's portrayal of nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court. What have you learned so far about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's legal pedigree? What do you notice about the way she is portrayed and talked about in the press? Do you think that a judge's background affects how they rule on cases? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. Judge Amy Coney Barrett became the fifth woman seated on the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020. Overall, 115 justices have served on the high court. Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, if confirmed, would be the first Black woman, as we've talked about, to ever serve on our nation's highest court. As we look at SCOTUS gender history, how it informs today on The Morning Show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pew Research Center pointed out recently Black women account for a small fraction of the federal judges who have served to date. What do women bring to the bench? Who is your favorite woman justice through time and why? 800-642-1234. University of Houston law professor Renee Konaki Jefferson stays with us. Renee, some Republicans have criticized the idea that race or gender should be a qualifying factor for SCOTUS. What do you make of these complaints?
Well, I find them to be completely disingenuous. They fly in the face of history and past practice of presidents from both parties. In this instance, it's not at all unusual for President Biden to have narrowed his search for a nominee to a particular demographic. And it's not to say that she's qualified because she's a Black woman. She happens to be exceptionally well qualified in addition to also being a Black woman. And in fact, there were many that could have been selected because Black women have long been qualified to sit on the court and in fact were shortlisted all the way back to the 1980s when President Reagan put his first shortlist together to put a woman on the court. By the way, just as Biden did, Reagan campaigned on a promise to put a woman on the court and make his first nominee to the Supreme Court female, which in fact he did. On that shortlist, of course, was Sandra Day O'Connor. She came off to become our first female justice. But also Amalia Kearse, a judge who is a Black woman and sits to this day in senior status on the Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. And even in more recent history, we have an example of a president narrowing his search when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. President Trump, in short order, promised he would put a woman on the court to replace her. But I think his exact quote was, "I like women better than men." Presidents for a long time have narrowed their search to certain demographics, not just women either, I should point out, but in the past have focused on geography, wanting to have a more diverse bench in terms of where the justices had grown up, where they had come from. And religion also has been a demographic that some presidents have looked at. So the idea that President Biden is doing anything unusual here, or that somehow the only way Judge Jackson has made it to this moment is because of her race or because she is a woman, is just silly.
I thought it was interesting, too. You bring up during the Truman, Harry Truman administration, a candidate who was shot down because the Chief Justice thought it would get in the way of how men deliberate with their shoes off and their shirt collars open. And, you know, and it's not just that sentiment that this is, you know, a man's only type club, but just that the Chief Justice could have that much bearing on who that nominee would be.
Well, when we think about the early women who literally threw the courthouse doors open, they had very explicit barriers to their presence, both in terms of the way their male counterparts felt about the idea of presiding over cases with a woman. I mean, it's Florence Allen, by the way, who was considered by presidents, I'm going back to, yes, Truman, Hoover, and FDR. She was the first female on the Ohio Supreme Court, and then the first female judge on the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. FDR put her there in 1934. And when she joined the court, there wasn't even a bathroom for her to use in chambers. I mean, this is, you know, literally a workplace that was not prepared for women. And in my study, there were 9 women who were officially shortlisted by presidents before O'Connor joined the court. And in learning about what they had to endure, not only did they have to be at the top of their class in law school, but when they left trying to find a job, they were often told, "We can't hire you because we don't have appropriate facilities here for women." In other words, they didn't have bathrooms or a place where they felt that women would be, you know, allowed in professional life. Now, of course, women no longer face such explicit barriers, but the fact that we have had women on the Supreme Court for 40 years, and now only now are we seeing a Black woman join the court, I think is proof that barriers do remain, and they are even higher for minority women.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson, law professor, University of Houston, a researcher, author at the intersection of gender, power, law, and leadership. You can join in with your thoughts on the nomination, 800-642-1234. Judge Susie Sharp said, you know, oft a bridesmaid, never a bride. It seems as if, you know, some of these nominees, they've been shortlisted multiple times.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in fact, a good example of that, and one that I think is really relevant in terms of how we are at this moment and seeing our first Black female justice join the court, is to go back to Amalia Kearse. So again, she was first shortlisted in 1981 by President Reagan when he selected O'Connor. Now, Reagan had more than one vacancy on the Supreme Court. He could have given us our second woman or our third woman on the court, but he didn't. One was enough for him. Judge Kearse, though, was shortlisted again by him for the seat that ultimately went to Justice Kennedy. Then when George H.W. Bush was facing concerns surrounding his nomination of Clarence Thomas, Kearse's name surfaced again as a possible solution if Thomas's confirmation had failed, which of course it didn't. And then most recently, Kearse was shortlisted yet again by President Clinton for the very seat, Justice Breyer's seat, that will now finally go to a Black woman.
In our few moments left, how would you think Judge Jackson would fit into a court environment that leans 6-3 in favor of conservatives?
Well, she will certainly be part of the three, right? And I think she's going to have a really important role here. Even though it's true, the ideological shift will remain 6-3. The three women judges, or just justices, will often be acting in dissent. And what they write and how they write it matters. It matters because we know that dissents can pave the way for a change in jurisprudence in the future to eventually become the majority opinion. Mm. It matters because dissents can rally the people to action, to perhaps go to the legislature to make a change. And she will offer an important counterpoint. For the first time ever, the nation is going to see four women sitting on the Supreme Court. They are diverse on many levels. And that's important as symbolically for the nation, not just to see at that high level, but thinking about women in professional life in general. Being able to see them remove stereotypes of what women can and should do, and allows for so much more possibility. And she, of course, will be bringing that to her role as well.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson on the Ideas Network.